All right, everyone, I'm going to call this meeting to order. It is February 16th, 2015, and this is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5032.
Madam Chair, 5032, of course, is the military budget, and we will be hearing about the governor's budget for the military department today, and then military will be done. The materials for the governor's budget are in OLIS, but they are posted on the 10th of February when military started. There are also new materials on OLIS posted on the 11th of February, and they have to do with Senator Winter's questions about veteran services that military department provides. So it's quite an extensive array of materials, and they're posted on February 11th. And that is all I have.
Art, come on up. I hope you are feeling better. We missed you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Ayer. I'm with the Chief Financial Office in the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm here to provide you with a brief overview of the military department's budget and the governor's budget. And before I start that, I would like to say from my heart, thank you very much for allowing me to delay this until today when I'm actually well enough to do so. Really do appreciate that. The agency, I think, did a very good job of covering really what they do and how they do it. I'll just speak very briefly to the fact that they, like many other agencies, do have deferred maintenance issues. They oversee the operation of the 911 system, and that system's frame relay architecture is going to essentially no longer be supported in another couple of years, and so it's a time-sensitive issue to get that converted to the internet, so that's one of the issues they're dealing with right now. They have a number of citizen soldiers overseas who will be returning in the not-too-distant future, at least some of them, and so reintegration of those citizens, citizen soldiers is a very important issue for the agency. And there is a bill that they have, Senate Bill 235, that I don't know if it has already received a referral to Ways and Means, but I wouldn't be surprised that it will, and that's why I bring it up here. It's a bill that will help the agency simplify its accounting. I think the agency did a very good job of showing how they relate to public safety through national defense and local emergency response. So getting right to the budget issues, this is a graph that shows their 2011-13 actuals, the current biennium's legislatively approved through December, and the proposed governor's budget for the 2015-17 biennium. I'll call your attention to a couple of things here. Number one, between the 2011-13 actuals and the current biennium's legislatively approved, you see a fairly large increase in federal funds. I think there are several different reasons for that, but actuals in federal funds tend to be substantially below legislatively approved because there is federal fund limitation available for disasters in case those disasters occur, and that limitation is already there for federal assistance to be applied without delay. I'll also call your attention to the difference between the bottom tier. Actually, the colors don't look so good on the screen, but the bottom tier is general fund, and between the current biennium's legislatively approved budget of $21.9 million and the governor's proposed 2015-17 budget of $26.2 million. That's an increase of $4.3 million, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the investments that make up the bulk of that increase.
I didn't think you were going to be here today.
No, I made it. So the investments that the governor's budget includes in the military department's budget include $1.4 million of general fund for the Air National Guard compensation above federal reimbursements. And this is for firefighters in the Klamath Falls Air Base. And the Air National Guard has changed, as I understand it, or chosen to enforce regulations that prohibit them from providing reimbursements above a certain federal reimbursement rate. And so the state has chipped in for that in the current biennium, and this is continuing that into the coming biennium. The second is $0.4 million general fund for the continuation of 8 maintenance positions at the Portland Air Base. again, this is something that is currently being funded in the current biennium, and this continues it into the next biennium. Then there is the Umatilla Depot Caretaker Agreement. That's all federal funds. We're continuing that agreement. And I mentioned earlier the 911 system conversion from frame relay architecture to internet protocol. Making available in the budget $500,000 for that conversion. Those are 911 funds. So the 911 tax that people pay on their cell phones and other phone lines. And then there are some capital projects that are included in the governor's budget. And those capital projects raise new debt service by $1.1 million of general fund, and they entail $16.6 million of other funds bond proceeds. And I'll talk a little bit about a technical adjustment change that we are proposing to that. But the existing governor's budget, the way it was submitted, included projects for the Regional Training Institute in Monmouth, or the, I should say the replacement of that facility in Monmouth, the expansion and improvement of the Youth Challenge Program facility over near Bend, and four other planning and design projects. The technical adjustment that we are looking into and proposing is to add the Joint Forces Headquarters project that is the military department's highest priority, actually, for capital projects. This was a project that initially was delayed in our approval process due to concerns about possible wetlands issues, and unfortunately the timing of the resolution of that issue did not occur early enough to get it included in the budget. And once those once the information came through that showed that there were no concerns about building the Joint Forces Headquarters expansion where it is, we have determined that we'd like to add that project, but we need to figure out a way to do it within the existing capital construction limitation or bonding limitation. And so we're looking at other areas within the budget that possibly would not go forward or be go forward on a smaller basis that would allow this to be added. Comparing the governor's budget to the co-chair's framework, we don't have a lot of detail in the co-chair's framework, but it appears that the co-chair's framework does not include some of the things that I talked about just a few minutes ago. For example, the Air National Guard compensation down in Klamath Falls, and the continuation of the eight positions up in Portland, and the major capital construction projects. So those are my notes, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair, to be sure, both the governor and the co-chair's funding for the Oregon Youth Authority was proposed, correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnant, I'm not sure that the co-chair's budget includes the Youth Authority. I would have to check on that to be sure. I believe there, if I'm recalling correctly, it does not.
I was corrected, Oregon Youth Challenge by that.
I'm sorry, the Youth Challenge Program is what I meant, not Youth Authority.
The follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
In Colonel Stuckey's presentation, he listed long-term vacancies. Does the military department justify to the governor's office, or do they justify the 70 long-term vacancies?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Wisnant, we in the executive branch, as we're building the agency's agency request budget, we work with the agency to come up with a vacancy savings estimate. And in that process, we look at long-term vacancies and determine whether or not they should be counted as savings that will go forward into the next biennium. And we look at each one of those positions individually and make a determination. So I would say, if I understand your question correctly, yes, they do justify those to us, and we make a determination as to whether or not those should be considered as long-term savings that will show up in the next biennium.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So And I don't think our job is to micromanage this program, but so you're saying they did submit justification to the governor's office, and the governor's office is supporting continuation of 70 long-term vacancies.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Wisnant, I don't know that I can make a definitive statement that we made that as a conscious decision. We did make a conscious decision as to what their vacancy savings dollar value would be based on their historical level of vacancy savings and where we expected them to go.
Those are not savings. If we budgeted for them and it was in their budget and they didn't fill them, that's money they had and they're just returning that money.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Wisnant, what our assumption, our formula assumes is that there will be a certain amount of turnover within the agency and that each time a position turns over, it will be vacant for some period of time. And we assume that 2 months is a reasonable period of time. So we calculate that as a reasonable amount of reduction in the budget based on the number of positions they have and the amount of turnover we expect. But you're correct, long-term vacancies are a bit different. And generally speaking, as the agency is proposing its vacancy savings, it shows vacancies that it believes should be filled or were kept vacant for reasons other than simple turnover. For example, if you keep a position vacant because you're using that cash, that savings, in another position to double fill another position or for some other legitimate purpose, that's a reason for not continuing that savings into the next biennium.
I'm turning it over.
I apologize. I had to testify in another committee, so take it away from wherever we were.
Okay. Thank you. I believe we were
all right.
Just open to questions.
My timing was perfect then. Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thank you. Linda, maybe you can fill me in on where we are.
We are now ready to hear from the Department of Public Safety, Standards, and Training.
All right. Please come forward. Thank you. Okay. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5032 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5534, the budget bill for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Thank you, co-chairs. For the record, Eric Gavlik's the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I'm joined today by Kelsey Ledford, who's our Business Services Division Director. Also in the back, we have three members of our leadership team that are here for the first time this year, Ways and Means. Ryan Keck oversees the Center for Policing Excellence. Gary Nidman's our Tactical Training Supervisor, and Rich Daniel is part of our Survival Skills section. So they're watching this process to see how the state creates its budget process. It's my pleasure to present the budget for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I know some of you have heard part of this before, so we're not going to try to bore you and drill down too far, but we'll obviously be glad to answer any questions we can throughout the process. Our mission statement, very straightforward, to promote excellence in public safety by delivering quality training and developing and upholding professional standards. And throughout the presentation today and at the end, we're going to try to tie in what we're doing here at DPSST with the national dialogue going on with law enforcement in the United States, because I know a lot of you are interested in that. If you move to the next slide. The history of our organization really spans more than 50 years. We started as the Board on Police Standards and Training. Many of you know us as BPST. Then we became the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, BPSST. And today also, in addition to BPSST still existing, is the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And I'll talk to you in a few minutes about why those two exist today. And it's actually pretty interesting. In partnership with our constituents in the Oregon Legislative Assembly, over more than 50 years, our agency's mission has expanded to address the changes and the nuances in public safety here in Oregon. As I mentioned, we started as the Board on Police Standards and Training in 1961 with the sole focus of setting standards for police and corrections officer training from city and county agencies. If you see in 68, that act was created as a mandatory certification for peace officers in our state. In 1974, we moved from Camp Withicum and old Quonset huts at the National Guard base to Monmouth on the campus of Western Oregon University. In 1976, we delivered our first basic corrections class, and you see we really grew over the years to include parole and probation, telecommunications, which are 911 operators, emergency medical dispatchers. In 1993, I'm excited to note that Oregon State Police is included in the state certification system at that time. In 1995, the private security industry came forward to the legislature and to the board and asked to be regulated in the state voluntarily, and we do that for them. In 2004, we started construction of the new police academy, or the public safety academy, over on Amsoil Highway, which a number of you have seen. In 2005, the private investigators came to DPSST. They used to be part of what was called OBI, the Oregon Board of Investigators, and they just no longer could afford the overhead, so they came underneath our act. In 2006, the new academy was open. In 2011, we marked our 50th anniversary with police training. And in 2013, through legislative action in House Bill 3194, the Center for Policing Excellence was created a part of DPSST. So that really gives you kind of a layout, if you will, of the complexity of our agency. But also, we're going to talk to you about some of the exciting things that that partnership has created. So we'll move to the next slide, which is what we call public safety shared stewardship. We serve more than 35,000 constituents based off of that page that I just laid out, the chronological order for you. The way we operate is very similar to the Oregon Legislative Assembly with ways and means. We have five discipline-specific policy committees: fire, police, corrections, 911, private security, and then we have a 24-member board on public safety standards and training. So the board exists today much like it did in its origination, and that is that the board is the entity that sets the standards for the public safety industry, and today DPSST staff carries out the board's work. So the board is the one that sets any standards, so whether that's the duration of training, the type of certification, the maintenance, and all those different kind of things. So it's really a shared stewardship, and those committees all have to do their lift, and then that goes to the board to either approve or send back, or not approve in some cases, the committee's recommendation, and very similar to what you see with Ways and Means here. And while it looks complex, it actually works pretty smoothly, and what we call it is really the United Nations of Public Safety. Every discipline group that we represent has a vehicle where they can go and have their issues be heard, and then also then have it reviewed by a peer group of the board. We also do have, off to the side, you'll see the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board. Senator Westland many years ago created that in partnership with the Legislative Assembly, which is the ability to provide officers killed in the line of duty or permanently disabled an immediate $25,000 death benefits, and also medical dental assistance for their families that they left behind. And we honor their memories, and we manage that program. We're proud to do that. And I always say we hope that we never have to use that fund, but sadly it's there if we have to. We've had more than 30 families that have received benefits from that fund since it was created. And then also you see on the side we have Polygraph License Committee, a six-member board. We do license polygraph operators in the state, and then we do also administer the Governor's Medal of Honor Commission of seven members, and the first Medal of Honor was given last year to a deputy from Benton County, Oregon, who was shot in the line of duty and is alive today because of the actions that he took on the scene of that incident. So that kind of gives you the layout from the constituent side. The next slide shows you the internal operations of our agency, and we're not going to drill down too far, but this is the way we operate the internal organization. We have a total of 668 employees, but they're not all full-time. We have 112 FTE, full-time equivalents, but the bulk of our employees are part-time instructors. So I'll give you an example. We have one firearms instructor that manages our firearms training facility, but he is joined by more than 40 part-time instructors that come and work when we need additional range masters. So rather than have those people there every day, it's very similar to a National Guard type component where when we need them, they're there, and we don't need them, they're back at their home agency. So they are working for us part-time, or some of them may be retired, and in some cases we have agency loan people. But we include that as an FTE because each of those folks requires supervision, requires scheduling, and also has the potential to put our agency in risk. They mostly carry firearms. They do provide training, and we do have oversight over those people. So they're all a personnel file within our human resources section. Flipping, if you have no questions, we'll go to FTE count versus the previous 10 years. So you'll see we did have a peak in 2007-2009 of 170 FTE. We are now at the current level, which you see on the right-hand side. Those years, quite honestly, in 2007-2009 were the busiest years we've ever had. Agencies were hiring officers, deputies, troopers faster than they can find people to fill those slots, and then it all kind of leveled off. And it really ties into how the economy is leveled off. But you'll hear in a few minutes, we're concerned about where things are going in a good way. And we'll talk about that as we come up. So the next slide we'll cover with you. We move into the training elements of the agency. Most common to most people is the academy basic training function, where students come to the academy here in Salem. For basic police, they're with us for 16 weeks. We train city, county, state, tribal, university officers in the same program, and it doesn't matter if you're from Portland Police Bureau or Port Orford, Oregon, you're going to train together for 16 weeks in our basic training program. We also have a basic corrections program for local, city, and county, which is 6 weeks. We no longer offer basic training to the Department of Corrections. They do it in-house, and we audit their training program, and that was a legislative decision made a few years ago. For parole and probation, we provide a five-week basic course, and then we have an additional week for armed parole and probation officers. Not every parole and probation officer in the state is armed. That is a county-by-county decision, but if they do carry a weapon, they come back and spend a week with us in training. And then for 911 operators and medical dispatchers, they're with us for 3 weeks of training. The last two elements, which we call COD, Career Officer Development, are for officers either out of the system for 2.5 to 5 years or coming into Oregon from another state that are already certified. They come to the academy for a two-week class, which primarily is legal instruction, the Oregon Criminal Code, Oregon Motor Vehicle Code, and any high liability issues that we have here that we want to make sure that those officers understand before they're going to go out on the streets of Oregon. It's not a skills class. They already know how to handcuff. They know how to drive a car. This is truly to make sure that they understand the Oregon legal process that we have here in place.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, we have elected sheriffs and things that have, some of them may not have ever had training. Are they required to go and get some sort of training, or how does that work?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, we have the authority by statute. The DPSST lets the county clerk know if a person could put their name on a ballot to run for sheriff. So even when they're considering running, we have to determine that they meet the qualifications, which is they have to have criminal justice experience. We have had two experiences where we have had, and I'll be honest, the oldest graduate ever to finish basic police at the age of 72 was the sheriff of Klamath County, Oregon, Frank Scraw. He had worked for a number of years in Los Angeles as a police officer, retired and bought a beautiful homestead in Klamath County. His neighbors elected him a sheriff. He did meet the requirement to get his name on the ballot, but had not been in any training for more than 15 years. He was required to come back for 16 weeks of training. He graduated, and he was not at the bottom of the class.
Thank you.
Okay.
Director, can I ask you another
yes.
question? Can you tell me how DPSST then interacts with the Portland Police Bureau's training center there?
Sure. Co-chairs, Senator Shields, DPSST has a very good relationship with the City of Portland Police Bureau. We understand that we were actually very supportive of Portland Police Bureau's need for a training facility, which is what I would call an in-service advanced training facility. They do not provide basic. They have no interest in providing basic. But through our partnerships, and since I've been with the agency for 23 years, they have moved all over the city to provide in-service training. They never had a dedicated facility. So more than 100 years after they were formed, now they have a dedicated facility on Airport Way, which is a firearms driving course, a firearms training program, a small driving pad, a simulator type village inside of a fixed building, and classroom. So they have a place now where they could provide training. We have a great relationship with them. They have a sergeant assigned to DPSST on a part-time basis. So it's another venue for us to provide training, but at the same time, it's a fixed site for Portland to do training.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
This might be getting off the topic just a little bit, but the new academy is a great place. Maybe a little perspective of Camp Withy come June 1 of 64 when I was there, state police. The urinals appeared to be like hot water heaters cut in half. And they're out in front of you about 4 feet, and behind you were the open toilets. Nothing in between them, and if the guy next to you was chunky, your cheeks touched. They were that tight. There was about 25 of those in a row.
EMI.
Thanks for that, guys.
I love this guy.
The Quonset huts that we stayed in, at that, the first time I was there, were fired by coal. So you drew lots who had to go out at night to get the coal in a sack and stay awake for an hour for your time to put it. So they really have come a long ways compared to the facilities that were there. Those facilities, the guys at the state prison at that time were in far better facilities than what we were trained. But it was quite an experience, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
Are you suggesting that we go back?
I don't think you probably...
Was it the cheek you liked?
Well, the showers were almost as bad because you had to wear thongs on your feet because there was so much stuff on the floor of the showers. It was a real experience.
Co-chairs Representative Krieger, I'm not really sure where to go with this.
No, but I will just
tell you that we're very proud of the facility that we have today, but we do honor the traditions of the past.
Representative Gorsuch, I'll come back to you.
I'm glad I went when it was in Monmouth at Western Oregon. But I do have a question for you. In terms of, and you may be not there yet, this is Academy basic training, but are there also command class sorts of things that are offered by DPSST, or is that done more regionally?
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, we're going to come to a slide. Thanks to the Center for Policing Excellence 3194, we were able to bring back our supervision middle management program, and I think you're going to be pretty excited about what we're doing there.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Winters?
Thank you. Just I'm glad that we were able to facilitate the move from Monmouth to Salem. And it is a beautiful facility for those who haven't been there. And along that line, Senator Shields talked about the training with Portland. And I'm thinking in terms of the national issue that's before us that has to do with the issue in both Ferguson as well as New York. And is there any discussion between Portland and DPSST of how we structure curriculum that it becomes useful for all so that we're ahead of the curve on this particular issue?
Co-Chair Senator Winters, a great question and a great opportunity to share what's different here. We're very unique in the state of Oregon, not only that the board and the constituents have created the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. Quite honestly, some states don't even certify their law enforcement officers or have a statewide standard. We've been doing it for more than 50 years. The other thing is some states don't have the ability to decertify officers. And you're going to see here in a few slides that we actually do decertify actually on an ongoing basis and have a very proactive standard here in the state. But what's unique about the fact that we train together, city, county, state, tribal, university officers, that doesn't happen in other agencies in other states. There are bifurcated training programs where the city, county, state officers don't even see each other because they train separately. Through the legislative initiative to create the new academy, we're able to do something very unique here, and that is to have a training academy that not only gives us very good classrooms and very good dormitories, but hands-on scenario-based training opportunities. So we have more than 100 acres on campus dedicated to hands-on scenario-based training. Not a criticism of Camp Withigham or Camp Rialia or Western Oregon University, but we really were landlocking those menus. So when you went to the firearms range, you were just going to do firearms training. When you went to the driving course, you were just going to do driving. You never had the ability to bring all those things together in one place, and that's what the new academy allows us to do. The other benefit of having everyone in to the state academy is that city, county, state, tribal officers not only are training together, but they're interacting in those scenarios together. And that's the reality of the world. And it's not a criticism of Portland as our largest agency, but even in Portland, there's going to be times that either they're backing up a deputy or a trooper or vice versa. So they're training together at the academy, and everybody leaving at the end of 16 weeks knows what they've been trained. So there's really a higher level of understanding of what those other officers have been trained to do and how they're also going to interact when they get on scene. So we're pretty fortunate to have that here, which doesn't exist in most other states of the country.
I'm speechless, only because I do commend our officers and what's happened in Portland and DPSST. Mm-hmm. As you know, that I was probably one of the big moving forces of getting it from Monmouth to Salem. Mm-hmm. and working with the community to make certain that we had the whole friendly neighbor issue resolved. But there have been problems in Portland. maybe not to the level of Ferguson, but certainly it's there. And you know, my question is whether or not there is either interim steps or ongoing to address those particular issues. And I don't think in Oregon we've done such a tremendous job, not only in talking about what happened in Ferguson, but also how to address the issue of the mentally ill and others that our officers are having to struggle and deal with, and whether your agency is preparing to address and deal with those in conjunction, whether it's Portland or other parts of our state.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, I think we have the perspective that we want to be proactive. So we've been watching Ferguson. We've been watching New York. We really watch all the national stories to see what the ripple is in Oregon, to see what we can do to improve here. I think when the U.S. Department of Justice did its review of the Portland Police Bureau, we took that review and looked at what are we providing in 16 weeks of basic training here. One of the things that we were not doing that we do now is that we did not have a co-instructor in our basic police class that had a mental health background. So now we have a partnership with Lines for Life where we bring those folks in to be adjunct instructors with us. And the same is going on with police legitimacy discussions around the country, use of force issues. I know, for example, with the chokeholds from New York City, we haven't taught a chokehold for more than a decade here in Oregon because it's not necessary. There's other ways to detain and apprehend a suspect. So we're constantly looking at the national issues. I'd be remiss if I did not also share with you that on Saturday we did have a member of our staff testify in front of the President's 21st Century Policing Initiative in Phoenix, Arizona, specifically on what Center for Policing Excellence is doing with our leadership and mental management training. So we're doing a very good job. I'm not going to say a great job because I think there's always room for improvement, but we're always looking at what's going on in the communities of Oregon and across the country to see what issues we can do here to better prepare the men and women that serve.
Senator Bates.
I'm sorry, I got called out to the committee for discussion. Have you had a chance to talk about the training program as far as profiling is concerned?
We're getting at that, yeah, right now.
Okay,
but I think what, and I would agree with, I think the underlying premise of Senator Winter's concern is that we need to do a better job in the state on how we deal with deadly use of force issues, particularly in. I don't know if that has to be at DPSST. It might be at the Portland Police Bureau, but it's something that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Williamson.
To follow up on that, I'm interested in, I know we're going to go into the Center for Policing Excellence later on,
mm-hmm.
but I'm very interested in what the curriculum is and has been developed over the first year of the program,
mm-hmm.
and where, if anywhere, in basic training or in advanced classes, there's a cultural competency component.
Sure. And co-chairs, if you wish, I could have Ryan come up now, who's part of that, because that seems to be a focus you have, and we're glad to do that. I mean, we could work it into the slide set very easily.
I'm okay either way. If it's coming up, I want to put that out there, that that's something that I would like addressed
mm-hmm.
at some point.
It will be near the end, but if you want to spend time on that now, we can move there.
I'm okay, as long as it's part of your presentation.
Yes.
We don't want to throw a monkey wrench into
okay.
it.
Okay, you're fine. We'll be flexible. So, okay. The next slide, then, just gives you a picture of CFAA, Criminal Fines and Assessments, and local funding. DPSST is really a state-local partnership, which is that local agencies write traffic citations, which generate funds that come into criminal fines and assessment. So when an officer gets hired by a city, county, tribe, university, state agency, they come to the academy. We don't charge for them to be trained. So you see, we're spending on the state side $21,000 to train that officer, and then the agency is providing salary benefits for that officer while they're with us for 16 weeks, which is the equivalent of $33,000. So we include this every time in this because people wonder what's the local government's participation, and that is that funding for that officer once they get hired through the process to come to the academy. Next, we're going to give you a very high level Center for Policing Excellence overview, which is what the 3194 reinvestment did. We did reestablish and develop a brand new 80-hour supervision course, which Ryan will talk about the details of that, but it covers a lot of the things that you're interested in. We also do have an 80-hour leadership and management program, and that would be for the command staff. Supervision is for sergeants, primarily first-level supervisors, and then management's for captains, lieutenants, command staff that are at the higher level. We also do operate a 160-hour program called IPSLE, International Public Safety Leadership and Ethics Institute, that we do offer at the Academy. We do also embrace evidence-based policing as part of the Center for Policing Excellence and are trying to put that into all the different basic training curriculum. We are also migrating to technology, which is getting away from what I call death by PowerPoint to problem-based learning using iPads. What we look at is high school, middle school students right now are learning by using iPads and the cloud and all this technology, and we're migrating toward that same platform because those are going to be the future students coming into the public safety profession. So either we could try to train them in the way we learned, or we could try to train them the way that they're used to learning in school. So we're making that migration on an ongoing basis to move over. And then we also are moving toward facilitated learning in our basic classrooms. And all those are elements really out of 3194, which were directives to DPSST. And I have to just remind people that we've only been doing this for just about a year. So we're still baby steps in here. But when Ryan comes up, I think you'll be pretty impressed with what we're doing. The next slide is criminal justice advanced training. We talk a lot about what happens at the Academy, but this is what we do off campus, which is how do we help provide advanced training to law enforcement officers. You'll see last year we provided 277 classes to more than 5,000 students. We do offer a variety of classes, primarily in an instructor development area, which is emergency vehicle operations, defensive tactics. But in a lot of communities, especially rural communities, we're the training provider for them. So Lake County, Oregon doesn't have a full-time instructor. Our regional person based in Central Point is the one that's coordinating training and delivering training. The same is true in Eastern Oregon. The same is true in the South Coast. Our regional folks are out there delivering those training classes in partnership with the local agencies. And through 3194 last year, we were able to double the amount of regional training offices. We used to have just two. One was based in Bend. The other was based in Pendleton. And through $3,194, we were able to add two here in the Valley, one based in Central Point and the other one here in the Valley to help really develop not develop, but to deliver advanced in-service classes across the state for these officers. But I would be very honest that this is the tip of the iceberg. We do what we can with the staffing we have. We work in partnership with the local agencies, but by no means are we the only provider. But in most cases, we are the only training officers that they have because they just don't have staffing to do that. The next slide we move to is fire training and certification. DPSST does provide training and certification services to more than 11,000 career volunteer firefighters. We do have regional field offices across the state. Last year, we offered 724 classes to more than 7,900 firefighters across the state, and we issued just over 3,500 certifications to those people. This training is primarily offered at nights and on weekends and not on the campus here in Salem because 80% of the fire service are volunteers. So this is usually done nights at weekends at local fire stations. We have a number of mobile props that we take around the state, and we do training basically in our backyard for them. Next slide, we get into the standards and certification. Representative Wisnett's question ties into this. By statute, we oversee officer certification, cradle to grave is the term we use, and that's to set the standards for them to be employed to the standards for them once they are employed. So that includes the revocation of their certification denial. We do publish a monthly ethics bulletin that I know is in your packets, but the ethics bulletin shows when officers have made bad decisions that have resulted in them losing their certification. It's used by our agencies across the state as a learning tool, usually in roll call, to show that this type of conduct will end your career in law enforcement. You'll see that the number of revocation cases last year, we're very pleased that we only had 79. Sadly, last year we had 79, and that means that somebody's career was basically brought to an end because of a bad decision. Sadly, drugs, sex, money are the big three. Untruthfulness is also usually part of one of those three. But we do hold officers accountable in the state for what they do here, and that's done in partnership with the board and with the policy committees. You also see the number of cases we open. So we're actively working these cases in partnership with the agencies. Usually they're a pretty major news story because it's something that we don't want to see in public safety. But on the flip side, as I said earlier, in Oregon, at least, we do have standards to hold people accountable, which doesn't happen in other states. We also have one of the things that, before we jump off this slide, we do handle maintenance for certification. That's one of the issues where we get to use of force training and the ongoing training. We also are the custodian of records for all the officers that we train and certify. And also last session, or actually 2012 session, we had Senate Bill 412, which is up for a sunset, which now tribal law enforcement officers are also fully certified with police officer powers anywhere in the state of Oregon. So we've worked with each of the tribal law enforcement agencies to make sure that they uphold those standards. And that program has been implemented very successfully with them. The next slide, we're moving into private security, private investigators program. This program is funded by itself. It's a fee-based program. So we certify private security professionals. We license the managers. We also license private investigators. We do have two compliance coordinators that go out in the state and do ensure that compliance is held on the field. We also do certify instructors, and we do deliver mandatory training programs for them. These, keep in mind, are citizens that either are armed or unarmed. They have no police officer powers whatsoever in the state.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the length of training, because I know probably what was it, around the year 2000, we didn't have any training.
Right.
What is the current standard for armed and unarmed security?
The current standard last year was an 8-hour class for an unarmed officer. Now that's going to a 2-day class in partnership with the private security. And then there's an additional 2 days if you're going to be an armed security officer. So it will be roughly a week. Now, keep in mind, that's the state minimum. A lot of the private companies, the larger ones, do a lot more training than that because it's very specific to the facility. So it may be a Fred Meyer that does not have armed loss prevention people, but they're going to cover loss prevention for Fred Meyer. The hospitals obviously have more unique programs based on the complexity. And then we do have companies like Securitas that's their whole business, is providing that service. So they do provide additional training to what's the state standard.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have kind of a phenomena going on in Southern Oregon, especially in Josephine County, where the number of people being hired for private security is ballooning. I know one organization has gone from 10 or 15 to over 200 now. Do they come under this? Does their company come under this? How is that all handled?
Co-Chair Senator Bates, if they are a private security provider that is being compensated, then they are underneath our act. If they are a volunteer, let's say providing security to church just to get people in and out, then they're not. So if there's a de minimis, so if there's no compensation, they're not underneath the statute. If they are receiving compensation, then they are. The other thing, and I was going to cover this later, but I could do it quickly now. The other thing that we're seeing, Senator, that troubles us is that we have now discussions with fire departments where they want to arm their firefighters in those counties because they're responding to calls where there is no law enforcement to provide them with protection. And they want to arm their firefighters to be able to take action if needed. And we're just not interested in engaging in that because it's way outside the scope of practice, and it opens up a lot of liability.
Mr. Chair, for discussion, I guess, emergency medical responders and firemen are concerned in Josephine and other counties. They're going to sites where they are endangered in domestic disputes, and we are concerned that one time a fire was set to entice them in to be shot at. We're not sure of that one. Plus, we're starting to see groups of individuals who are not being paid but are setting up their own security in their neighborhoods, and they are armed.
Right.
Are you aware of this, too?
Co-Chair Senator Bates, we are aware of them, but again, if they're not providing it for a fee and it's just a group of neighbors, we don't have any statutory oversight over them. We're concerned, as you are, but we also have to work within the confines that we have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. That's, you know, some of the discussion we had last session when those counties failed to actually pass their levies. And so this what's happening in those counties is something that we feared because of that. And this body, we actually added, I think it was $1 million. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Rep. Baker and Williamson to provide the state additional state troopers in order to try to provide some backup. That was only a short-term solution to a long-term problem, and it's not only your county now, but we probably have some of the same situations. And I know Polk County has now put their tax back on to go to the voters. But it is a serious situation, particularly in those counties that have not passed their levies in order to provide adequate law enforcement protection in their communities. So I'm sure we'll hear more of it, particularly as we talk about, and I talked to someone this afternoon, on what the impact and implications are for Measure 91 and how that plays out in particularly Southern Oregon.
And Co-Chair Senator Bates, I would say, and to add on to Senator Winters, we're aware of Polk County, Curry County, Lane County, but Josephine is probably the most active in its discussions about how neighbors are trying to make sure that their communities are safe. The challenge we have is how far do we go within our statutory authority when it's really neighbors just trying to protect their neighborhood as opposed to an armed security company that has some sort of a oversight board, if you will.
Gotcha.
I was just curious. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Rep. Gorsuch, and then we're going to have to try to catch up after this question.
So I'll do this really fast. Just to tie in with what Senator Winters and Senator Bates were concerned about, the problem also is the fact that we don't fund the Oregon State Police to its authorized strength, which is another problem.
Yeah.
And so there, what I see is the base level, which is the state police, we don't even do that statewide. So, I mean, that's a secondary
problem. We haven't done that since Governor Attia, so
yeah.
Just to put him a little 2 cents worth.
Yeah, it's a problem for sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Okay, so we will move to the next slide. We've mentioned Public Safety Memorial Fund Board. I'll just cover with you, since it was established in 1999, more than $1.7 million to date has been given out to the families. And also, we do have one person permanently disabled in a line of duty that has not gone back to work. So you see $25,000 payment, health and dental insurance, mortgage payments, and higher education scholarships. And the number appears to be consistent between roughly 140 and 190 in that area. Every biennium that we have there. The next slide is our admin and support services. We can go through these pretty quickly, but the director's office basically manages the agency, consults with the board. Our business network services division oversees the financial reporting, but also oversees our network administration. We have a voiceover IP campus, so that is something that we share there. Instead of having an IS director, we split that function. We'll move to the next slide. We have facilities, information services, and HR. Our campus spans 236 acres, includes 21 acres of protected wetlands, over 330,000 square feet. And I'm not going to read the whole list to you, but one of the things that I will share with you is that even though we will be at 9 years now with the new campus open in July of this year, we're coming close to end of service life for some of the equipment that's there on campus. So we've got a great facility. We've got a great maintenance staff that takes care of it, that extends the life of it. But probably in the next biennium, we're going to be asking for some dollars to replace some of the larger equipment that we have on campus here. As we move to the next one, we talk about budget drivers. We've talked about population growth, aging workforce, and I do really want to just take a second here, and that is with baby boomers. We are hearing now from our constituent agencies that they are seeing some very large numbers of retirements coming up in the next year or two. In our discussions with the Portland Police Bureau, they may have 80 retirements this year. The Oregon State Police may have 150 retirements in the next 2 years. Salem and Eugene each with 15. And then we also do have a new police department forming up at Portland State University that will be trained at DPSST. I share that with you because as we look at what we have requested in our budget, we may not have enough classes in the hopper if all of these come true. So we believe we're where we need to be. But if these retirements do actively occur and other baby boomers from agencies leave, we may not have enough classes. And our concern is we don't want agencies waiting for more than 4 months to get an officer, trooper, deputy into a basic class at the academy. So we may have to come back and ask for additional dollars for classes. But we're not there today. But we don't think we'd be doing our job if we didn't at least plant the seed that that could happen with retirements coming up. So the rest is really where we're at. We have seen an increase in litigation costs with the Attorney General's office. That's one of the policy option packages we have. While we had less revocation denials last year, we've seen a new trend where people that are getting revoked have nothing to lose, so they can have a contested case hearing for 5 days. And the state pays for that on our end, and they figured the worst that can happen at the end is they lose their certification. We do go through that process to make sure they don't come back into the system, so we have seen that. And then we do have growth and stability questions ongoing with fire insurance premium tax, as well as criminal fines and assessments, and I know that you look at that as well as we do. Any questions on budget drivers?
Okay.
Challenges that we have, just to finish up this part, we have relied on volunteers and agency load instructors. You'll see that last year was the lowest amount of hours we received from both volunteer and agency loan, down to 7,300. That means if we don't have those folks coming in, we do have to provide part-time trainers to fill those slots. We're currently at 100% usage for our part-time trainer pool, so there is no more for us to give there. We do also calculate what that equivalency is for the volunteers that we get an agency loan, and just under $200,000 will be the value that we get there, or the equivalent of 1.77 FTE. Sadly, last year, 17 students went home because they either failed the academy or committed violations on campus that required them to depart. And then we also had 19 students either drop out or removed by their agencies. In many cases, those are students that may have had problems before they came to the academy. In other cases, they may have been problems that occurred at the academy, and they're just not a fit for the profession. So each of those requires that they go home. If they get dropped by their agency, they don't come back. It's different than an injury. If an officer has an ortho injury at the academy, their agency can recycle them and send them back if they choose to. This is a different discussion that we're having here. Okay, so measuring performance, we cover by the broad, how do we measure our performance? So we have a very active QA/QI program on campus. We do monitor the students' progress. We do check in with their agencies on a weekly basis to let them know. We do bring coaches in for the 16th week of basic police training called Calls for Service, where the coaches basically get to see the product before we send it home. We also do conduct a listening tour every 2 years. We go across the state to 14 locations and listen to our constituents tell us how we're doing and what we can do better. We do also have a lot of constituent feedback through the different outreach efforts that we have with the chiefs, the sheriffs, the fire chiefs. We do validate all the training we provide through job task analysis. The most recent one in the hopper right now is the basic police course. It's due. It's a 5-year rotation that we have. And then we do have input from the board on a quarterly basis as well as an ongoing basis. They are making sure that what we're doing is not only current but correct. And that also ties into the discussions on the national discussion about holding people accountable.
Just a question. How is your board appointed or selected, and is it reflective of individuals in the state?
Co-chair Senator Winters, our board is a hybrid board, which means that if you are, some of the seats are, if you serve by virtue, so the superintendent of state police, the director of corrections, the Portland police chief, the Portland fire chief, the FBI agent in charge, they automatically are on the board. The rest of the seats are designated by who has that seat. So we have two police chiefs, two sheriffs, we have labor, and we work with those bodies to get us candidates from across the state, but we're looking for diversity. And diversity includes statewide diversity. So we want people from the South. We want people from the East. We also would like to have more women on the board, but we work with our stakeholder groups to get that board.
So is it fair to say, given that makeup, that you really don't have much in terms of a diverse board today? You may be seeking that, but what kind of ethnic minorities do you have on the board, women and what have you? I just happen to think, since the, you know, we start talking about curriculum policy and all of this, how does that board reflect our desire to have a diversified, culturally competent board?
Co-chair Senator Winters, I would start with the global. I would say that every public safety agency in the state wants to be more diverse than it is today. We are very much white male. I'm not saying that that's where we should be, but that's the challenge that we have collectively, is to recruit more females, more people of color, more people of different diverse backgrounds. So we're all working on that. We as an agency work on that not only internally, but also with our stakeholder groups. So we do have a female police chief now on the police policy committee. We do have, I believe, the corrections policy committee is equal female and male. We see in 911 profession, 90% of that industry is female. So that's one of the unique natures of that job. But parole and probation is about 50-50. So we continue to work on that. But I would say it's not just we, DPSST, and the board, but it's also the larger whole. We want to look more like the people that we serve.
I think that follow-up that Representative Williamson talked about curriculum, have you thought, since you haven't arrived there yet or got there yet and you're working on it, that maybe there's a way that you can bring in maybe others to help with this this ethnic cultural piece? Because, you know, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here right now. You know, it may take us a long time to get to where we want to be, and in the interim, we need to actually make certain we've got curriculum and training that actually reflects some of our desires.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, I believe one element, and this is just one off the top of my head, that I think we're doing something very good. Unfortunately, Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, LECC, is no longer funded. We have been providing LECC tactical ethics classes as part of our basic police training, as well as on a regional basis out of DPSST budget dollars at the expense of other regional advanced classes. So we have a member on LECC, Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, that also includes ACLU and a number of other public private partners. So we see the value of collaborating across the state. We're never going to be done. We're constantly looking for partnerships, not just at the academy, but in our regional programs. And in some classes, the better person to teach is probably not a law enforcement officer. It's somebody from the community that understands the issue. And I believe, to our credit, and I know some of the members from Portland know this, but Richard Brown served on our board for 6 years, and he termed out last year, so he's no longer on our board, but he still comes down twice a week to the academy, sits through our programs, gives feedback to our instructors, gives feedback to me about what we should be doing. So we are addressing or trying to address the issue he brings up. So we're very much aware that things need to change, and we continue to work in that direction.
Do you think it would help you to facilitate it if your board structure was actually requiring? I know that Brown, and I met him, mm-hmm. Required that you actually have this balance on your board?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, I would be appreciative to have a diverse board, but I'm also realistic that I know out of the two sheriffs, right now there are no female sheriffs in the state of Oregon. So I can't ask for something to be created that's not possible from an elected side. But on the chief side, I know we're always working with them to find people that have diverse backgrounds to come onto the board. And in some cases, we've done better than others. But fire chiefs right now, I don't believe there's any fire chiefs in the state that are female.
I'm talking about maybe Portland, a layperson.
Oh, I'm sorry, Portland. Aaron Jansen is on a board. You're right. Thank you.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but those appointments are approved by the Senate, correct?
Correct. Thank
so
you.
We do have some influence, I suppose.
Yeah.
Senator Bates.
You have anybody? Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have anybody of color on the board?
We do not have anyone of color. I believe we do have right now 4 women on the board out of 24, but no one of color on the board.
And Richard Brown was appointed through the Senate appointment process.
Yes, and he served for 6 years, and he was great. Yeah, and now his replacement is a female from Newport who just came onto the board through Senate confirmation, so she just joined.
Okay.
So we actually have 5 then. Yeah.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the process, is this through the executive branch, and then it's confirmation by the Senate? So part of the problem could be because of the appointments that are coming forward in terms of the folks that are being forwarded to the board.
Co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, I believe it's really the pool that we have. And it's not a criticism of the pool, but the Chiefs Association has to select someone from their group to be on the board. And Chris Allison, who's now on our police policy committee, is, I believe, the only female chief currently. We mentioned Aaron Jansen's is the fire chief from Portland. But other than that, the fire chiefs don't have any other pool to pick from. And I also don't believe there's any fire chiefs of color or police chiefs currently.
Representative Gorsuch.
This will help me understand this. Mm-hmm. How does one have, what are the qualifications to be on the board of this 24?
Thank you. Co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, the 24 is really broken out mm-hmm. as far as who those seats are slotted to. So 2 of those are police chiefs, representatives, 2 are sheriffs. We have a state firefighters council representative, which is labor. We have a non-management police officer, non-management parole and probation officer, which is a female. We do have the automatics, which are the agency statewide agency type, Portland Police Chief, Portland Fire Chief. And then we have a 911 representative, which is female. We have the citizen representative, which is female, which comes through the governor's office to the Senate. But they're all laid out. So it's not a, the seats are all slotted toward a certain right. statewide demographic. Okay. Two private security representatives are on the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, please. Senator Bates.
I just point out that there's a new sheriff in Jackson County.
New sheriff in town.
Okay. That's right. Thank you.
Falls.
Yes. Thank you, Senator.
He's an African American.
Yes. Has there been any thought, and perhaps this is something that your board can think about, to actually including in their numbers, and you have to come back to this body, but a layperson. I find that sometimes as professions, we actually talk to ourselves, think to ourselves, and respond to ourselves, and sometimes don't get that extra outside layperson viewpoint of us and what have you. Has any thought been given to perhaps, adding a lay member or whatever to the body?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we haven't gotten to that level of detail yet. What we do is all of the basic courses that we provide, they work them with their ways through a work group that we bring in of subject matter experts from the field. So we'll ask agencies to give us a person to participate on that. That's a subject matter expert. Then that works through with our staff to develop what that program is. Then it goes to the policy committee for review. Then finally to the board for review. So there's really three levels of scrutiny that it gets. I'm not saying that we can't improve what we're doing now, but the citizen member does see that at the board level, as do other members of the discipline. So you have, and it's somewhat unique, but you have fire chiefs and corrections officers looking at and approving the curriculum for police officers, and vice versa. So there is some check and balance.
I guess, Eric, what I'm thinking of, what I'm thinking of, and looking across not only Oregon but across the country, where you have this disconnect, mm-hmm. or this, whether perceived or real or thought, we do have a climate now. And I'm just suggesting that perhaps maybe we need to look beyond ourselves, and maybe get some different perspective. I've talked to my people here locally, and where we've had my chief going out meeting with individuals in the church and what have you, so that we can actually collectively begin to connect with the community in which we serve. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it helps us if we've got that on our actual boards. I remember when I was putting together some of the boards myself when I was on the executive side, we always try to make certain that we're not just talking to ourselves in our own environment, but it's good to have somebody there to kind of keep us connected, if you will.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, I don't disagree. We're always looking to make a better product for all of Oregon, not just for public safety. So I can't disagree with that.
Let's accelerate through and get as much done as we can.
Thank you. So we look at cost containment efficiencies. We basically work with the public safety partners at the state level. Two of the programs I'll share with you, we do use inmate labor on campus for some of the exterior work that we have. We also do recycle through Department of Corrections, so that's e-waste. We send our computers to them. They look to see if they could reuse them within their facilities, and if not, they do recycle them and pull out all the components that they can resell as part of their program and put it back into their operating budget. The other thing is cardboard. We used to pay to have our cardboard taken away. Department of Corrections now picks up our cardboard and they package it and then they sell it back to recyclers. So it's a change of philosophy, but it works out pretty well for us. The other thing that we do is we work with the Oregon State Police. We do have some vacant office space on campus based on the reductions we had. We do host the recruiting and training sections on campus. In the past, they were located up at Camp Rialia, so all that training is done now at Salem. We also do offer office space to the Tribal Gaming Session, the State Athletic Commission, both underneath the State Police, but in the past, they used to lease space. Now we lease vacant state space to them within our facility. And then we also do have the Oregon Youth Authority Training Division on campus now. In the past, they used to use commercial lodging, commercial classrooms, and now they provide that training on campus as well as dormitory and food services. So, again, we're trying to use the campus to its full extent because empty rooms are heated and cooled just like full rooms, and it just makes sense for us to be good partners. And then we work with our other public safety task forces, so whether it's electronic payroll or fleet maintenance or those type of things, we're constantly looking to see what we could do better. The next slide I'll cover really quickly, and I know Senator Devlin has had interest in this in the past. This is how we meet 41-31 with the 11-1 ratio. Quite honestly, we can't meet 41-31 because of the number of part-time trainers we have. We have gone through the process that's established for that. We do have an exemption from the Department of Administrative Services for that, but we just wanted to show you how we get to that number because, honestly, we're at roughly 14-1 when you consider all the part-time trainers that we have on campus. And our concern, obviously, is if we reduce the amount of supervisors, we have things that can hurt people, if not kill people, if they're not properly used, and we're always concerned about that. Okay, we'll move through the KPMs really quickly because I know we want to get the CPE. The first one is our police officer training, which is how they improve from when they come into the door and when they leave. So we're showing improvement there. This is one of these that's ongoing that we're working on. The number two KPM we have is regional training. How useful are the programs that we're providing? You'll see we're roughly in the 85 percentile, which we're pretty happy about, but obviously we love to be at 100. The biggest criticism of our regional training, in some cases, it's more of same. It's in service, for example. It's hard for a person to get excited about CPR first aid when they do it every year. But the question is, how successful are we in delivering them the ability to do CPR first aid? KPM number three is fire training, which is how successful are we there? You'll see it's slightly higher there. We're at about 92%, which we're pretty happy about. And in fire training, for 80% of that, as I mentioned, is volunteer firefighters, and we're giving them hands-on skills training that they probably haven't had before. In KPM number four, we look at our professional standards, which is how we address revocation and denial, and how many cases are upheld at the appellate level, and we are at a solid 100%. We continue to be there. This is a goal that we want to be at because we do not take decertification lightly. It means a career of a person is over, and we think we should be shooting at 100% if we're going to go through that process. So we continue to work through that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So that is through the Administrative Procedures Act, goes to the Court of Appeals afterwards.
Yes. Co-Chair Shields, our process is very complex, but rightfully so. So we do cover the Administrative Procedures Act. We do also have mandatory and discretionary revocation cases that the legislature says, if you do this, it's not a review by a committee. It's automatic. Staff takes it. And others that go to the policy committees. So they're complex. It's not uncommon for a case, once it gets to us and we move forward, just to take 6 months to move it through the board process. And then we schedule a contested case hearing after that. With the person. But through any part of that process, what is unique is if the person says, I'm going to appeal my termination to the employer, we put a stay in. We do not stop. We stop what we're going to do if they're going to still exhaust their rights with their employer.
Thank you.
So we move to KPM number five. This is a new one, but this is the average increase in corrections officer training test scores. So we're working on that. So we honestly don't have anything to report yet. That's a new one. The same is true of our KPM six, which is increasing the professionalism of the private security industry. This also is new one. We don't have enough data yet to show you a trend. And this one we really struggle with because honestly, a lot of the people in the private security industry don't see themselves as professionals. In many cases, it's a minimum wage job. It's something that they're doing through school or to make ends meet or part time. But then we have other people that do this truly as a career, whether it's a Bonneville Dam contract project or something else with a larger company. But we really struggle to work through this or a private security committee to say, what is it actually that we're trying to measure? So we'll hopefully have something for you next time on this. But we struggle on it. I'm not going to sugarcoat it with you. Our next KPM is our records accuracy, which is the rank of accuracy and availability as above average. You'll see there we've got great numbers there compared to the past. We're at 100% accuracy for our records, which is where we should be as the custodian of records. And our next and final KPM is the customer service ranking. So that's accuracy, availability, expertise, helpfulness. And you'll see there we're in the 80 to 90 bracket, depending on what different industry group we're working with there. So, again, always room for improvement to 100%, but we're doing a fairly good job there. Okay, so we'll move into funding sources. Some of you have been here before, so you know how this goes, but this is where DPSST's budget comes from. The bulk of our criminal justice programs come from criminal fines and assessments, so that's standards, basic police, corrections, PMP. Our telecommunications, emergency medical dispatches from the 911 telephone tax. Our regional training is either criminal fines and assessments or an ODOT grant that funds a full-time dedicated position for transportation safety training. Fire certification is completely funded by fire insurance premium tax, private security completely funded by licensing fees or civil penalties, and the admin is funded by criminal fines and assessments. The only debt service we receive is to pay back the obligation of the facility. I'm sorry, general fund we received is for debt service. The understanding there years ago was we're going to have to pay for the building anyway. It doesn't matter what account. We should just take it out of general fund, and that's the way it's been since that. So any questions on funding? Okay. As we move to program priorities, and this is the biannual, which one of your children is the most popular? It's very difficult for us to rate these, but what we do is put criminal justice training as number one. We're the only agency that does that in the state. Criminal justice standards for the same discussions we've just had about Ferguson in New York. We believe that's important. Fire training and certification, and then the other programs fall in line underneath that. Again, these are all different fund sources, but we have to do this as part of the budget presentation to show you where our priorities would be. We move to the next slide, CSL, and I don't know how detailed you want us to get into this, co-chair. This kind of gives you the snapshot.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. And then the next slide will give you the breakdown of the pie chart of what CSL looks like for 15-17. 46, 682, 850 is the total, and you see it's broken out by the different priorities. Then we move to the next grouping, which is governor's budget, which is 15-17 current service level plus policy option packages that we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, with the total being 47,503,085, 15-17 with governor's budget. And then the next slide will show you how that breaks out if we were going to slice it up by program area. Okay. We'll move to policy packages. Policy package 101 is a package that we've asked to be introduced. It ties into some of our early discussions. We believe that we should and need to do a better job in mental health crisis intervention training, not just based on the issues going on in Portland, but across the country. We do provide some solid basic training, but that's not enough. We need to do more with our external partners, both private and nonprofit, as well as our constituent groups. And this is to deliver advanced classes off campus as well as on campus, specifically for mental health crisis intervention. This could be as basic as a four-hour class for the 911 dispatcher dealing with one of these calls, to the first responding officer, firefighter, or to the corrections officer that's going to deal with this person when they get brought into the intake facility. So those are two positions there. That's a start for us. We won't know how successful we are until we do that, but what we're doing now obviously isn't enough, so we need to do more there. Package 102, Center for Policing Excellence Advancement. This is to establish one training specialist and one research analyst. The training specialist will continue the conversion of our basic training over to the iPad or scenario-based type learning, which we need to go to. And the research analyst is to do a couple of things. One is to not only help us look at how effective we are in basic training, but how successful students are when they leave the academy. Are they still working 18 months later? Are they still working 3 years later? And how that basic training program has affected them. The other thing we want to do is to do some research on law enforcement practices for agencies less than 100,000. Most of the national studies are based on Bureau of Justice Assistance grants, 100,000 or larger. That's great if you're Salem, Eugene, Gresham, or Portland. That doesn't help Amity. That doesn't help Ontario. So we want to do some research in those areas tied into the Center for Policing Excellence, but also bring in our academic institutions, for example, Portland State University, Western, that have active research programs, to bring in those kids in the summer that are looking for projects to go work with public safety agencies to get those projects going and to create some research. And then obviously to look at how successful those programs are when we implement it. So it's not just doing the research, but now applying it to the craft. And then package 106 is professional standards enforcement. And this addresses the increase that we've seen in our legal expenses, where we have people taking us to the mat on a number of cases. And the option for us is not to move forward with them and let them keep their certification. So this provides additional dollars for us, not any bodies, but dollars to cover those cases. So any questions on the POPs?
Just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your mental health crisis intervention, is it your plan to actually take and utilize curriculum and some of the best practices that have already been done by some of the other states, so that we're not reinventing the wheel? Is that the plan?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we would like to look at everything that's out there. So we have a lot of information on the Memphis Crisis Intervention Training Program out of Tennessee. We see a lot of other programs across the country. So we don't want to reinvent the wheel and create something new. We also want to bring in our mental health community into this discussion, because it's not just a public safety issue, it's a community issue. So we want to broker with them as well to have those individuals help teach these classes. We know along the I-5 corridor, a number of agencies implemented some very good programs. For example, Marion County Sheriff's Office, Salem Police Department have a very good program. Portland continues to work on
that. I asked that question to lead you in.
Thank you, Senator. But what we also know is that we have Lake County, we have Grant County, which doesn't have a 24/7 mental health person to respond. So how do we get training out to those people and work with those community partners to basically link up public safety and public health together to be able to have effective resources for those type of emergencies?
Representative Williamson.
On policy package 102, tell me how that research analyst would be different than what is happening with the CJC, the Criminal Justice Commission, around 3194 and their data collection.
Co-Chair Williamson, we are brokering and partnering with CJC on a daily basis. Every meeting we have, they're part of our advisory committee. We would basically want to meld what we're doing in partnership with them, so we're linked together. One of the things we've discussed in our supervision program, we have students come as part of their project and identify a community project they want to work on. So they develop that over the 2 weeks. We're talking with CJC about giving those agencies baby grants to go back and then implement those programs. So we're seeing a very strong partnership with CJC. We also have talked about CJC creating the webpage for Center for Policing Excellence so we could post all of these best practices online. So rather than reinvent the wheel, we're working with CJC on a daily basis.
And that makes perfect sense. And that was the intention with 3194. I just wonder around data collection and analysis, if that's properly in CJC or in your agency.
Co-Chair Williamson, we would not want to reinvent the wheel on what CJC is collecting, but what we see is the other body of work, which is not the data, but the issues.
Okay.
So, you know, the fact that we have a study from St. Louis, for example, or Miami, Florida, about how to implement some sort of policing program may not help the agency in Oregon with three officers. So we want to do specific research in those areas to get to Oregon policing, which, 80% of our agencies are 20% or less, 20 officers or less in the state, and some have less than five officers. So we want to do things specifically that allow Oregon chiefs and sheriffs to do proactive things here.
Thank you. And I have the gavel again, so if anybody. Senator Bates.
Thanks. This is a question that I'd like to have answered offline. You have access to the scope of the problem in mental health. How often or how many calls police officers across the state receive to go out on a mental health issue? We're talking 5,000, 7,000, 1,000, 10,000. I won't expect you to know that right now, but if you can find that for me, I'd appreciate it.
I will.
Thank you.
Yes.
Anyone else? Right.
Okay, so we move to current legislation with a direct impact on DPSST. Obviously, ballot measure 91 will have an impact. We don't know what it will be yet, but we're actively monitoring those discussions, and we'll let you know as things solidify there. We also do have both House Bill 2684 and Senate Bill 211. This is a change in PERS. DPSST currently has a sunset that comes up. We are able to hire PERS retirees full-time in training positions at the academy. We requested that ability years ago, and that is because we sometimes struggle to recruit quality people at the academy. We have people that are very knowledgeable from the Portland Police Bureau that are able to work for us full-time, and we have one of those. We did have two. But this allows us to retain that knowledge, skill, and ability here in the state. And the challenge we have is we're not an agency that has overtime. So officers that are mid-career at an agency won't come to work for us full-time because their salary is not going to be the same. And while it's great to work Monday through Friday, they're just not in the same compensation discussion. So what we look at, and this is not a criticism of any retiree, but they have to have the passion to be a trainer. They're not just there to collect a check. And those are the kind of people that we have. And right now we have five retirees that work for us, and they're just fantastic. So that's the change there. Senate Bill 496 would include certain workers' compensation claims as qualifying criteria for the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board. We are concerned about the bill as written because right now it would open up the door to hundreds of additional cases, and the fund just can't sustain that. So if, say, says that somebody is permanently disabled, then that would mean that they get Public Safety Memorial Fund Board, which is different than the current statute, which says tied to a singular event on the job. So we're following that to see where that comes up. House Bill 2372 says that the department is the one that certifies and not the board, and this is involving urine tests of a person arrested for operating under the influence. That's a Scribner's error that wasn't caught when the board and department was split out. Senate Bill 238 requires a private safety agency to comply with certain standards for personnel records. This was an agency-requested bill where agencies currently, in a few cases, have parked their documents onto an island, for lack of better terms, in the legal world, that we cannot access them, and they can use those documents to make the decision whether they terminate an officer or not. We would like to have access to those documents.
Representative Barker.
And I'd just like to go back. You don't need to flip the page back, but about the retirees. Portland Police now are under OPSERP, so eventually you will run out of them as well. And yes. Portland, the reason Portland Police and Fire can do that is they have a different pension system than OPSERP. So that's why you see a lot of chiefs of police around Oregon that are retired Portland police and not from Salem or someplace else because of that provision. And that does seem to be a dated provision and time to change it. Thank you.
And then we move to Senate Bill 239, which would include reserve officers in a definition of public safety personnel. This is something that came out of a request from the Police Policy Committee and the board, which is to have reserve officers have the same background standards as a full-time officer. They do access the criminal justice information system, have information at their fingertips, and the board felt it was necessary to have those reserves have that same background standard that full-time officers do. And it's Senate Bill 343 or 389, both address the tribal law enforcement. So there's been two bills introduced on that that will be coming up this session that I know many of you are aware of some from the judiciary side. So any questions on the legislative pieces? Okay. So as we move to state and national dialogue, and our timing is pretty good here, we already have mentioned with Senator Bates the discussion of arming firefighters that causes us concern. We are also involved with Oregon Emergency Management and the governor's office and the state fire marshals on crude oil trains, and when the impact on that is on the emergency response community. The studies have shown, or the surveys, that agencies do need additional training. We do not have the capacity to do that now. There's an additional fiscal tied to this discussion that is working down another path. And then we move into the national discussion on policing. So I think the best thing for us to do is to have Ryan Keck come up, who oversees the Center for Policing Excellence for us, and we could talk about what we've been doing with 3194.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, Director. Larry Platt has already told me I have to say yes to everything. Two things. You saw what I talked to the military department about, the vacant positions. Could you provide the committee a list of your vacant positions? I hope it's been vacant for 6 months or longer. And second, could you provide me or the committee, there's House Bill 4057 passed in the 77th legislative session 2014 that asks you to report on successes of hiring military veterans or certify them for security positions and polygraph based upon their military training. If you have done that report, a copy, that would be most appreciated.
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, the first one is easy. We have zero vacancy savings, so we need all the positions we have, and we fill them as soon as we can. And thank you for the reminder on 4057. As you remember, I testified on that bill, and we do a lot with veterans, even though we have employed some veterans when we can and when they apply. What we do is easy to report, but I don't believe we've submitted a report yet.
What we're looking for is not so much you've employed them, but you've certified them as polygraph or,
yes,
or private security people based upon their military.
Yeah, and we'll get that report in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Keck, and I coordinate the Center for Policing Excellence at DPSST. As we've discussed already, there's a great deal of attention and inquiry focused on the role of police in society, the tactics they use, and the training they receive. In this discussion, Oregon Center for Policing Excellence, also known as CPE, has received national recognition for being proactive in addressing these concerns. Much of this is through innovative and effective means that have been inspired by House Bill 3194, as well as guided by our advisory committee, which is made up of city, county, tribal, and state police officials. As mentioned already, just this past weekend, CPE member Steve Weininger testified before the President Obama's Task Force of 21st Century Policing. Dr. Weininger's recommendations focus on education as the key to ensuring police officers provide fair, effective, and valuable services to their communities. So in 2014, CPE has provided over 200 public safety supervisors and managers with education focused on leadership development, improving organizational performance, and ethical decision-making. Each of our three programs are conducted in a cross-disciplinary setting so that officials from police, telecommunications, corrections agencies can all collaborate together to look at Oregon's challenges related to in their communities as well as the justice system as a whole. Two of our leadership programs dedicate 24 hours to evidence-based approaches for developing public trust and confidence, reducing fear within communities, and using research and analysis to effectively reduce or decrease crime. This evidence-based practices segment was recently evaluated by the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs. The evaluators commented that the education provided in Oregon was far ahead of other efforts in the United States. Specifically, the evaluators were impressed by CPE's community-oriented approach, its translation of research into relevant context for practitioners, and the promotion of strategies for improving police legitimacy in conjunction with data-driven crime solutions. As has come up already today, and a part of the national discussion on police and community relations, we provide a complete day of training that's focused on helping supervisors and managers recognize how social dynamics and implicit biases may influence their behavior, and how to develop ethical and unbiased decision-making skills. In this course, students are required to complete two implicit association tests, which were developed by Harvard University, to measure attitudes and beliefs a person may be unwilling or unable to recognize about themselves in regards to race, age, and gender. An added benefit of our leadership training is also that students require the projects Director Gablix has already spoke of. As mentioned, students are asked to identify and analyze a specific problem within their own community or their agency, and then research and develop both a response as well as measures of effectiveness. We've found that many students subsequently implement these projects within their local jurisdictions, and we're hearing about successes ranging from measurable crime reductions in city parks to newly established public safety policies. It's for this reason, then, as the director has mentioned, we're working with the Criminal Justice Commission to align these projects with the Justice Reinvestment Program. As the body of knowledge on effective police practices continues to emerge, CPE is committed to furthering the use of credible research, data, and evaluation within all levels of public safety agencies. Again, already mentioned is our work with the Criminal Justice Commission and the Vera Institute to develop an online platform to provide public safety professionals with easy access to relevant and accurate information related to evidence-based practices. Additionally, we've developed a partnership with George Mason University's Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy to assess the factors that influence police and corrections leaders' awareness and acceptance of research on what works in enhancing community safety and reducing recidivism. CPE is also developing an 8-hour course to be presented regionally to Oregon police officers and executives on research related to police legitimacy and procedural justice. And these same concepts have also been recently introduced into the Basic Police Academy. Finally, CPE is actively developing DPSST's use of research and effective teaching methods, such as student-centered facilitation and problem-based learning, in order to enhance the department's training programs. These progressive approaches engage students in exercises designed to promote critical thinking and emotional intelligence, so while at the same time acquiring job-specific knowledge and skills. By deliberately focusing on the development of critical thinking skills, we can ensure that new officers are not only aware of laws and tactics, but can evaluate when they are most appropriately applied and how to do so fairly in unfamiliar or unexpected circumstances. Further, by creating learning environments that foster emotional intelligences such as self-awareness, self-regulation, and empathy, we find that that will be critical in the development of behavioral traits necessary to prevent the issues at the heart of the national dialogue about police conduct. Currently, DPSST has fully integrated these educational practices into its leadership, corrections, and parole probation academies, as well as select basic police curricula focused on ethical behavior, interpersonal communication, and the use of decision making. We believe that education is transformative. Therefore, as the roles, the tactics, and the training requirements of America's police are impacted by social, technological, and economic changes, DPSST and the Center for Policing Excellence is dedicated to providing the education Oregon's public safety professionals need in order to adapt and ensure the fair, efficient, and effective public service that they're asked to do. With that, I'll entertain any questions.
I think that, thank you, Madam Chair, that someone mentioned some conversation about profiling, and I know that there's some bills that are circulating around this session on that various subject. So can you talk a little about how your curriculum and your training addresses that particular issue?
Madam Chair.
Racial profiling.
And Senator Winters, yes. So in the Basic Police Academy, there is specific 8 hours related to cultural competence, as was spoken earlier, which includes both classroom facilitation and dialogue, as well as scenario-based training to get at the students' ability to interact effectively with individuals of a diverse background. In addition, as mentioned by Director Gablix, we've provided grant funding to LECC to continue their provision of the tactical ethics, which is subtitled Perspectives on Profiling. It's a three-hour course that we're currently able to coordinate provision to basic police students that come through our doors. And it focuses on exactly that, how to effectively, if you will, and appropriately criminally profile without it being a racial or a bias-based profile.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you think you're doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we believe, as the director said, there's always room for improvement. But as a start, we're doing what we can within the academy that is designed and the resources that we have available to us. If I may go on a little side note, the area of police legitimacy and procedural justice are both fairly new in terms of research in the academic realm. We're trying to stay ahead of each of those and utilize those and make sure that we apply then the concepts from each of those concepts into multiple areas of our training, whether it be at the leadership or the basic level, as they revolve around issues beyond just race, gender, or other cultural diversities, but just in general, how students, that is our police officers, interact with their communities.
Well, would you have any objection to a database being developed that recorded encounters with people of minority and recorded in those encounters how often they are actually charged with something?
Co-Chair and Senator Bates, I believe the challenge with any kind of database is it's only as good as the information that's put into it. And I think one of the things that's been discussed with LECC is that under the current system, which was a small study, officers are making a decision on what type of ethnicity a person is based on their interaction, which may or may not be anywhere close to being right. So granted, data is going to help drive this decision and how we make decisions. I think the question is always the how and the why. You know, how do we make that decision? Why do we do it? And then where does it go? So it's not as easy as just, you know, making a stop and then filling out a box about what that person believed. Because the discussions that we've had is the more questions officers ask, then it almost seems to be that they're asking questions because of what nationality they are.
Follow up to you. I'll go back to the basic question and I'll give you a little background. Anecdotally, in Southern Oregon, we're having more and more calls about racial profiling. People being stopped so often that they actually leave to work an hour earlier than normal, and they leave an hour early every day because they know the odds of getting stopped are 100%. Okay? And they just know they're going to get stopped. Mm-hmm. They have all their stuff laid out, ready to go, and show their ID and everything. And then they're totally leave and go on their way. And it's obviously racial profiling. So the question becomes, is that just anecdotal, or do we have a bigger problem out there? And I don't know the answer to that.
And coaches, I believe tomorrow's discussion, because we're going to have three police chiefs come in and talk about partly CP and some of the things we're doing, would probably be a good discussion to have. One of those is our board chair. And I think collectively, this is an issue that everybody wants to get our arm around. I just think, again, it's the how do we do it, why do we do it, and who's going to manage it? Because that's, I think, with any kind of data collection, is it's only as good as what you collect, and who's going to be the repository to basically not only collect it, but also to scrub the information to give you a report that's worth using.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, this issue is not going to go away. And there's been enough in this building now that, you know, keeps percolating upward enough to where legislators and others have begun, you know, whether drafting legislation or whatever. So if individuals think it's going to go away, it's not. And it's not has to do, I don't think, and I've been around a long time with just Ferguson and what's happening nationally. There's been incidences that are happening in our state that is repugnant to individuals, and the question is, how do we wrap our arms around it to discontinue the practice, whether it's through basic training or, you know, but somehow, you know, we have, you know, stated that we're pleased that we've got this training in place, we're pleased that we've tried to be proactive, and we want to make certain that we're actually solving the problem. So, you know, I'd heard about the incident down in Southern Oregon. You know, there's the stuff that goes up in other parts of our state, out of Portland and what have you. You look at the disparity that happens in our various system, and it becomes alarming. So, and that's not just from the standpoint of the profiling, but it's everywhere from our foster care system to our OIA system to our DOC system. And so some of us are getting very, very concerned and want to begin to have some answers on this particular issue. We don't want a Ferguson, nor do we want a New York. We want to prevent that from ever happening here in Oregon. So I think, you know, this is percolating because we want to be proactive, and I do not believe that it's going away.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. Just one very brief question. So in terms of the current amount of training related to these topics, profiling and so forth, and did you say it was 8 hours currently?
Co-chair, Representative Corsic, there are 8 hours included in the Basic Police Academy for cultural competence, if you will, diversity, awareness, and effectively interacting. In addition to that, then, are the 3 hours that we've been able to provide related specifically to racial profiling.
And follow up. What are the total hours for the current Basic Academy? I know it's 16 weeks, so that would be...
Co-chair, Representative Gore, 640 hours. 16 weeks is 40 hours a week.
640 hours, and 11 are dedicated to that.
And co-chair and Representative Gorsuch, that is specifically to that area.
Yeah.
But we have what we call threads that run throughout the 16-week curriculum. So it's communication, whether it's in use of force, if it's in a vehicle stop, if it's in scenario-based training. So there are threads that run throughout that whole curriculum, and it really accumulates at the basic 16-week, which is calls for service week, where we're seeing them in real scenario-based training. But it really starts the minute an officer arrives on the scene, which is the interaction and the credibility that they establish just when they get out of the car and how they approach that person that they've encountered now. Whether it's a vehicle stop or just having coffee at a Starbucks, there's an interaction that occurs between a citizen and an officer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I have one question following up on training. In addition to cultural competency, another thing that we're hearing a lot about in the building is trauma-informed care. And I wonder if in your training you have any trauma-informed curriculum around whether it's interacting with victims or others.
Co-chair Williamson, we're not aware of that term, but we do cover, obviously, child abuse, domestic violence, all the different what we call crimes against family, and how do we not only render aid to that victim, but also assist them with the legal proceedings from there on. So we do cover those elements of it, and that's throughout the not only the, what's required in statute and in classroom, but also then in the scenario-based training. So we're continuously working on that issue, but it's one of the many things that we're trying to really give a new officer in 16 weeks. And that's why the mental health policy option package is beyond basic. Now, part of it does help bolster basic, but we're really giving people a lot of information in a short amount of time that in some cases have never even driven a patrol car. And now they're going to go out with their coach and continue to learn through the field training program. So it's a work in progress in a number of levels.
Thank you. Anyone else? Anything else from the agency? I think we're going to ask Art to present on tomorrow. Actually, no? Tomorrow?
I'll be feeling better tomorrow. Okay.
All right. Oh, sorry. Thank you. All right. So then I will close the public hearing now on Senate Bill 5534. And tomorrow we'll go to the governor's budget, the DAS presentation.
Oh, it's a couple of three.
Thank you.
There's three on the House.
Oh, it's a couple of three.
Thank you.
There's